I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. It looks like New Jersey will become the eighth state to allow the terminally ill to end their life. The Aid in Dying Bill was passed by the New Jersey legislature, and Governor Phil Murphy has said he will sign it. This is not the first time this kind of legislation has made it to a New Jersey governor's desk. It happened twice under Governor Christie, who refused to sign. Governor Murphy said allowing terminally ill and dying residents the dignity to make end-of-life decisions according to their own consciences is the right thing to do. There was emotional testimony on both sides of this very personal and difficult issue, with concerns about abuse and mistakes and support for autonomy and choice. We begin with Nicholas Pugliese, who covered this debate for The Record and NorthJersey.com. And Nicholas Pugliese, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. How long has this bill been sitting on the governor's desk?
It's been about a week now, and he has indicated he'll sign it in the next few weeks.
Do you know what he's waiting for, or is it just there other bills sitting on his desk waiting for his signature?
It's pretty typical for the governor's office to go through a technical review, but he signaled last week, as you mentioned, that he supports this. And it's been a long time coming. This bill was first introduced in 2012.
I described the emotional testimony. You were there covering this. What was it like to hear, frankly, from both sides on this issue?
Well, I mean, you have folks on the supporting side who have terminal illnesses themselves. They talk about family members they witnessed who had very painful, ends to their lives and talk about what having this choice would have meant for their families. And on the other side, you have some folks with disabilities who talk about, you know, the fears of the potential abuse of this law. You have opposition from religious standpoints and from doctors who say this goes against their medical ethics. So it's a very complicated issue on all sides here.
And how close were the votes?
One vote. It passed by one vote in each house, so it was as close as you can get in final passage.
And where does the public stand in New Jersey on this issue, as much as they may or may not know about what this bill includes?
Yeah, there hasn't been polling on it in recent years that I'm aware of. The last poll was in 2015. And I think, you know, polling varies on this issue depending on how you phrase the question. But a sizable majority in 2015, according to that poll, were in favor of it. So it seems like there is public support for giving folks this option.
Even though the vote was very close, as you said.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very tough issue for lawmakers. I think, you know, it's a big choice.
It's life and death, right?
Life and death, exactly.
Well, let's go through the bill sort of piece by piece, because it's important to understand, I think, the various components that are part of this bill. First of all, someone has to be terminally ill with an incurable, irreversible disease with 6 months to live. Can you just put some meat on those bones there?
Sure. To qualify under this bill, you have to, first of all, be what's called mentally capable, and that's the ability to make healthcare decisions on your own and communicate those decisions. And secondly, you have to get a diagnosis from two separate physicians that you have a terminal illness with less than 6 months left to live. Doctors readily admit that their diagnoses are not always spot on. So there's some, you know, controversy over, you know, how reliable that 6 month diagnosis is. But there's other provisions of the bill that try to build protections around patients so that they don't make this decision in a fit of pique, so to speak. You have to ask three separate times for the medication over a period of at least 15 days. So all of those things have to come together in order for you to be eligible for this option.
Is there a diagnosis of being mentally capable? For instance, does a psychiatrist or a psychologist have to verify that this person is not, let's say, profoundly depressed?
That's a good question. It's left up to the discretion of the doctor, I believe, in order to refer to a psychiatrist or mental health professional for a second opinion on that matter. So there is, some provision in the law to deal with those types of instances.
So once they get this kind of approval, what kind of drug are they given? Do we know?
I don't know the specific chemical makeup of the drug, but it has been, in most states where this has been made legal, it's a pill or something taken orally or through the gastrointestinal tract. In some instances, I know that it's been administered through a feeding tube. I should clarify, the person who gets the prescription has to self-administer it. It cannot be given to them by anyone else.
And we should just underscore that. So it's not as if the doctor's doing it or even a family member or a close friend. The person has to do it themselves.
Correct.
I'm curious about whether someone can witness someone doing this to themselves, essentially administering this lethal drug. Are people allowed to be there as a witness?
Absolutely. I think the supporters of this legislation actually support this being, a decision and an outcome reached after robust conversation with a doctor, long conversations with your family. And, I spoke with one doctor who has written lethal prescriptions in Oregon under their law, which has been in effect since 1997. And he says almost every time he's asked a patient whether they would like him at their bedside when they actually take the medication, they've said yes. So in many instances, this is, ultimately the decision of the patient, but something reached in consultation with the doctor and the family as well.
Are the doctor or pharmacist, are they protected by this legislation?
Well, yeah, that's sort of the crux of the law. It protects from liability any doctor that participates in, prescribing lethal medication.
Are there protections for people who are disabled? Let's say someone has cerebral palsy or something like that. Are there protections in there for people with diagnosable disabilities?
So this is a point of contention, and I believe your other guests will probably touch on this topic. The provisions and protections we spoke about before are meant to protect, folks, say, with dementia or Alzheimer's. They would not be deemed mentally capable, at least in the advanced stages of their degree. And furthermore, you have to be able to communicate your healthcare decisions and to a doctor that you want this prescription. And again, just having a disability is not a terminal illness in many circumstances. So those provisions, and the New Jersey bill is based off of the Oregon legislation, which again was the first in the country. And the supporters say that that law has worked. There haven't been evidence of abuse there. And so, folks with disability would only qualify given they meet the other, eligibility requirements in the law.
You mentioned that there are people on both sides of this issue, including the Medical Society of New Jersey, said this was fundamentally incompatible with physicians' role as healers. I believe the American Medical Association and other medical organizations have not necessarily signed on to this idea or this bill.
Well, quite the opposite. They remain opposed. Their medical ethics, the guidelines for doctors, say that this practice is not ethical. It's been interesting recently. There has been signs that position may change. The American Medical Association at their annual meeting last year was considering adopting a recommendation to solidify their opposition to medically assisted suicide or aid in dying, however you may want to call it. And that recommendation failed. So although they remain opposed formally, they opted not to sort of, dig in their heels against this. And I know the Medical Society of New Jersey, which is the body that governs medical ethics in New Jersey, will consider this at their May meeting. So they're both opposed for now. There may be signs as more states change this law, adopt this law, that the opinions of doctors will change with it.
And how about religious communities or organizations? Did they line up on either side or one side versus another?
Well, the Catholic Church has long been opposed to this, and I know you have a guest coming up from the Diocese of Metuchen who can speak about her diocese perspective on this. But it was interesting. Many of the sponsors of this legislation as well as Governor Murphy, who said he would sign it, are Catholic. So clearly it did not break down neatly across religious lines.
You mentioned how emotional it was hearing from testimony on both sides. Was that something as a reporter that, you personally felt?
Absolutely. I mean, these stories are heart-wrenching.
They are.
I think everyone I spoke to, it was just a joy to get to know them and their families on both sides of the issue. People aren't trying to score political points here. I mean, their positions tend to come from deep personal experience. You know, one woman I spoke to had, she was only in her 30s. Her husband was a military veteran who had cancer, I believe, and she was very happy that this law was not available to him because he outlived his diagnosis by many months, if not years, and she was scared that had he had access to a lethal medication like this, he may have taken it at one of his low points. So, you know, it's tough to criticize anyone on either side of this debate.
No, I completely agree with that. Who's behind this bill or this notion in New Jersey?
Well, the main sponsor, the main lawmaker who's been pushing this is John Berzicelli, an assemblyman from Gloucester County. I actually don't know if he has personal reasons for supporting this. I know the Senate president, Stephen Sweeney, said he supported it based on an experience watching an excruciating death of a family member. But I think they were very cognizant that this is a tough vote for lawmakers, and that's why it took 7 years and three attempts to get it through.
Now, Governor Murphy has said that he will sign it. As you said, it is on his desk, expecting his signature in the next couple of weeks. Once it is signed, and it's pretty clear that it will be, when does it go into effect? How does it go into effect? What do you see as the future?
Yeah, it takes about 3 months after Governor Murphy signs it to take effect. And it's been interesting speaking to doctors. So hospitals and healthcare systems are going to have some decisions to make in the months ahead, whether they opt out wholesale and don't let, you know, their doctors participate in this. But I think for a lot of hospitals and healthcare systems, they're going to leave the choice up whether to participate to their individual physicians. And so physicians have to, you know, start learning about this law. Compassion and Choices, which is an organization, a national organization that has supported death with dignity laws around the country, has said that they will set up a sort of interactive map where patients can find doctors that may be willing to prescribe or networks that may be willing to prescribe under this law. So sort of the infrastructure will be being put into place, Compassion and Choices says, by them. Some doctors will, I know I've spoken to a few doctors that are supportive of this. They said they'll use their networks in the medical community to spread word about this and to try to educate other doctors. Other systems will have to make decisions whether they're going to participate or not.
Well, Nicholas Pugliese, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And you're very welcome. State House reporter for The Record and NorthJersey.com. And yes, we do have the two guests waiting in the wings, and we will debate this issue after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We just heard from reporter Nicholas Pugliese about what's in the Medical Aid in Dying for the Terminally Ill Act, passed by the New Jersey Senate and General Assembly. It's on New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy's desk, waiting for his signature. Once it becomes law, terminally ill residents will have the option of taking their life once they have permission from two doctors who prescribe a lethal drug that the person can administer to themselves. Their diagnosis must be terminal within 6 months and be incurable and irreversible. As you can imagine, there was emotional testimony on both sides of this issue, as we heard from Nicholas, and firmly held beliefs about the rightness and wrongness of this bill and the right to choose death. Joining us now is Jennifer Ruggiero. She is Secretary of the Secretariat for Family and Pastoral Life in the Diocese of Metuchen and also Director of the Office of Human Life and Dignity. Jennifer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And also with us is Sean Crowley. He's Senior Media Relations Director for Compassion and Choices. And Sean, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Well, thank you very much.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. We want to know where you stand on this issue and this bill as it stands. And you can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I do want to break this bill down, but I want to get your overall reaction. And Jennifer, let me start with you. What is your major fear, your major concern about this bill in New Jersey?
Well, I think that there's a lot of things wrong with the bill, very bad public policy. I represent the Catholic Church, but I also am part of a broad coalition of folks that oppose the bill for a number of reasons, disabilities folks, patient rights advocates, healthcare professionals, veterans groups, and other faith-based groups. One of our major concerns is that in our cost-driven society that people that want to take advantage of this think that it's all about autonomy, but one decision from someone actually ripples out to the rest of society. And we've seen case after case in places where it is legal, where folks that are dealing with, you know, terminal illness or life-threatening these diseases, you know, want to have a life-affirming or life-saving treatment and are denied by their insurance companies because the cost of a very expensive chemo treatment compared to a, you know, lethal prescription is much higher, and sometimes the insurance companies are denying their life affirming treatment. And we've seen case after case of this, and we've had people come in and testify during the hearing. So this is one of the major reasons, but there's a whole slew of others.
And we will get to that whole slew of others. Let me give Sean Crowley a chance to put on the table. What is your major support for this bill?
Well, it's supported by a majority of New Jersey residents, including a majority of people of faith and Catholics. In fact, the Catholic support is actually higher than the general population, 64% versus 63%. And the fact of the matter is this bill is not really – it's not as much about dying as about the quality of life at the end of life. And by that I mean when people have this option or they even know about this option, they know they won't have to suffer needlessly at life's inevitable end. And it allows them, whether they use the law or not, to have the faith that they won't have to suffer needlessly, because they also explore hospice and palliative care. And, in fact, New Jersey, unfortunately, has the worst hospice and palliative care in the nation. And every state that's adopted this law has improved their hospice and palliative care. And I might add that we actually did polling, oversampling of people with disabilities in New Jersey, and their support was nearly the same as the general public at large because they want the same autonomy as anybody else. And as far as the cost issue goes, 90% of the people who use this law in Oregon are already in hospice. And the stories that Jennifer is referencing, there's no documentation of these stories. There's not been a single prosecution for abuse or coercion in the entire nation. These laws exist in eight jurisdictions with 40 years of experience. So if there was actually any abuse or coercion, there would have been some cases brought, especially by prosecutors who oppose this option. And yet that's never happened.
And let me jump in. And let me just take the law, once it becomes law, take it apart here. We're talking about people with incurable, irreversible, that's part of the language of the law, diagnoses with the thought that they would die within 6 months. They have to do several requests within a very specific time period, and two doctors have to sign off on allowing them to use a prescription drug to end their life. Jennifer Ruggiero, I'm just curious about, does that give you, I know you oppose this bill on all fronts, but does that give you any solace that it has enough safeguards for people who want to do this for themselves?
Right. I think that it doesn't. There are a lot of loopholes. I think that the whole idea of a 6 month prognosis or diagnosis is very, it's arbitrary. We all know people that have gotten a diagnosis and have outlived that. We have case after case of that. There's a woman in Oregon, Janet Hall, who went to her doctor asking for this prescription. Luckily, he talked her into a different path, and she's alive 15 years later. There are other doctors that would not go that route. So we're frightened that this 6 month and I think your previous guest, Nicholas, brought this up. The six-month diagnosis is very arbitrary, and there are cures coming out every day. There are different treatments coming out every day. So that's a bit of a problem. again, we worry that people that are depressed, we all know that cancer patients go through a cyclical depression, and one day they feel good, the next week they are seriously depressed. And if that's not being treated, we're worried that people that are just suffering from some depression are going to go this route. And there is no requirement. It's recommended that a person be screened for psychiatric problems, but it's not a requirement. So there's other issues as
sure.
well.
Hold on, only just because I'm trying to give equal time here and breaking this down and getting both of you to respond to you, Sean Crowley. Does this provide enough safeguards, especially for people who might be feeling depressed or upset about the fact that they are either in pain or dealing with some very difficult or even terminal disease or illness?
So doctors routinely monitor their patients who they've known often for a lifetime to see if they're mentally capable, if they're depressed. And that's required in law. The two physicians have to be sure that the patient is mentally capable. Anybody who requests medical aid in dying has to be advised of all alternative treatment options, including hospice and palliative care. The case that Jennifer referenced, that particular patient was going to refuse to have any treatment. So I would say that that was a different situation altogether. She was refusing any. She didn't want to do chemo. Again, these are anecdotal stories. There's no evidence of abuse. And as far as the insurance issue, here's the reality. Most people, first of all, insurance companies deny treatment for unproven, untested treatments, whether there is a medical aid in dying law or not. Now, we can debate whether that's right, but that's what they do. And there's no evidence that these laws impact insurance companies' decisions on that front, especially, as I mentioned, that 90% of the people who use the law are in hospice. And hospice is relatively inexpensive. The medication is actually very expensive, and not all insurance companies cover it. And the idea that a physician wouldn't look out for their patient is kind of absurd, too, because a physician makes a lot more money if he treats a patient than if he gives them medical aid in dying, right? I mean, there's absolutely zero. That's what's almost comical, frankly, about our opponents thinking that it's not sufficient that doctors are looking out for patients they've probably known a lifetime. The last thing a doctor is going to want to do, or certainly has no financial incentive, is to give them a prescription of medical aid in dying. They only do it because they don't want to see someone suffer. And I would argue that the Hippocratic Oath of do no harm includes not prolonging somebody's suffering when there's no hope for cure and no hope for any quality of life.
And I do want to pick up on that. Let me just quickly reintroduce, and I've got a caller who will be joining our conversation. That's Sean Crowley, and he's Senior Media Relations Director for Compassion and Choices. Also with us, Jennifer Ruggiero, and she's Secretary of the Secretariat for Family and Pastoral Life in the Diocese of Metuchen, also Director of the Office of Human Life and Dignity. We're talking about the Aid in Dying Bill. It did pass the New Jersey legislature. It is on the governor's desk. He said he will sign it. It allows terminally ill patients with a prognosis of less than 6 months to end their life using a lethal drug. You can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Let me get Lori from New Jersey to join us on Radio Times. And I should say to our listeners and to our guests, this is Lori Wilcox, and she did testify about this particular bill. And Lori, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
What did you tell the lawmakers?
What I told the lawmakers is my sister is suffering from small cell lung cancer. We are both former nurses. I myself have a life-threatening disease. I'm not terminal as yet, but both of us are living our lives to the fullest. We have witnessed many gruesome deaths. We have a lot of fear at the end days of our lives. We would like this option available to us. Not right now. Not that we're not living our lives to our fullest, but in the final weeks of life, we know how gruesome, how panic-filled, the anxiety and the pain that people go through. So we're very appreciative that this legislation has been passed.
Lori, are you concerned more about the pain that you and your sister might be feeling at the end of life, or other things about just the your ability to be able to move around and make decisions and be sentient, all that?
I mean, both of us suffer pain daily, but that's not a reason to use this medication now. We're talking about the very end of our lives. When we're in bed, maybe with pressure ulcers, maybe with air hunger, maybe with severe pain, maybe with my body rotting away, the final weeks of our lives, we would like to have this on our bedside to have the comfort of knowing it's there.
You said the comfort of having it on your bedside. Are you clear that you would use a lethal drug, or you want to have the option?
I want to have the option. Right now, my sister is living her life and enjoying herself, but I do not want to see the panic, the anxiety, and the pain that my mom went through with the same disease and no option for her to relieve that at the very end.
Well, Laurie, I appreciate your call to Radio Times and wishing you and your sister the best as you deal with obviously some very difficult issues. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. That's Laurie Wilcox. I'm curious, Jennifer, for your response. I mean, here's a woman who she testified in support of this bill. It sounds very clear-minded, and she wants to have this choice. What do you say in response?
Yeah, I can totally sympathize with Lori. I actually heard her testimony. It's very emotional and very, very touching. I actually went through the death with my mother. She passed from cancer, a long journey, and it's a very difficult time for everyone, especially those who love a loved one, and I my sympathy and heart goes out to her. My fear is there's something called the Oregon paradox, and this is data that we've gotten from Oregon where people will go to the doctor and request this prescription and decide that today is not the day, I'm feeling pretty good, and they put it in their medicine cabinet. Once that medication leaves the pharmacies, there's no regulation on that prescription. It's literally a bottle filled with about 100 capsules of Seconal. And that medication can sit in someone's medicine cabinet, and if they're not ready to take it, they don't take it. It's sitting there unregulated. We have such a problem with drug prescription abuse in our country that this is just, again, poor public policy that we would allow lethal prescriptions to be left on people's shelves. And there's quite a few people that don't take the medicine. They die from their underlying disease because it's never been the right time or they change their minds. It's nice to have that comfort that one day they might want to take it, but in a lot of cases it's not taken and the medicine is not looked after. Again, we also worry that there's an epidemic of suicide in our country. And if we're going to allow a certain segment of our population, those who are suffering because they're near death, to basically take medication to kill themselves or to end their lives. What are we saying to the teenagers that are feeling depressed or have some mental illness? What are we saying to the veterans who are in very serious pain or suffering? I think it's a very slippery slope that we would allot this one population to take their own lives. And basically, I like to call it doctors.
Well, you know what? I'm sorry to do this to you, Jennifer, only just because I got the clock and I want to make sure we have equal time for both of our guests. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Sean, let me give you a chance to respond both to what Lori said, but also what Jennifer said in response to Lori's story.
So my dad died very badly from Parkinson's, had terrible seizures, went into a coma. My grandmother died of pancreatic cancer. There was never enough pain medication to ease her pain. You know, this law is going to apply to less than 1% of all the people who die annually in New Jersey. And again, it's going to improve hospice and palliative care for people who even oppose the law. That's what history shows. Oregon leads the nation in hospice and palliative care, double the usage rate of the rest of the country. And the thing about the medication, first of all, there's state and federal regulations about the disposal of this medication. There are many medications that anybody's – if you took 100 pills of almost anything in your medicine cabinet, it would probably kill you. Mm. And you can't really take this medication and keep it down unless you take not one but two anti-nausea drugs an hour before you take the medication. And you have to prepare it. And you have to empty the capsules. You have to pour it in 4 ounces of water. You have to drink that. It's very bitter. So the idea that and then hospice, of course, 90% of people in hospice has medication disposal regulations of their own. So this idea that this medication is more toxic than other medications is just wrong, first of all. It's just that this is designed to make you go to sleep and not wake up. And most people I know, that's how they like to die. They like to die in their sleep. And people hold on to this medication, proving they're not suicidal. And to compare people who want this medication, who would love to live if you gave them a cure tomorrow, to someone who is mentally depressed, is not terminally ill, and wants to take their life is absurd. And there's zero statistical evidence that there's any correlation. There's one study that Ponis did where they claimed there was a correlation, but of course they lumped in medical aid and dying with suicide. So they basically admitted there was no statistical significance to the study when you excluded medical aid and dying from suicides.
We have about a minute before our break here, but let me go back to you very quickly, Jennifer. And I'm looking at a study looking at 18 years in Oregon, which has been referenced several times. 90% of the people who used Oregon's law were in hospice care. Most of them had cancer. They cited loss of autonomy, loss of dignity, and frankly, just, you know, feeling as if there was no future that they had, and certainly being in hospice care, there was probably some truth to that, that those are most of the people that chose to take their own life. Why does that bother you?
Well, it means to me that they didn't have anyone around or any kind of support system, community around them, helping them not to feel like they were a burden or that they couldn't do the things in life that they enjoyed. You point out that it's not the reason for this, that wanting this assisted suicide is not because of pain. It's because they're not able to do what they used to do. I have, well, I've shared this with Sean. My dad has stage 4 Parkinson's, and it's a very difficult thing to watch someone lose their capacity to walk, to talk, to swallow. It's a very difficult thing to watch, but there is some value to being by someone's side in those days and giving them the reason to live, the community, and I would like to also point out.
And I'm sorry to do this to you, Jennifer, only because we're up and on a very short break here, and we'll get back to our conversation. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and we're getting two very different perspectives on the Aid in Dying bill. Again, it's a bill that's on New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy's desk. He is expected to sign the legislation in the next couple of weeks, and it will allow terminally ill patients in New Jersey with a prognosis of less than 6 months to live to end their life using a lethal drug. And we've been talking about some of the safeguards that have been put in place, but as we've been hearing from Jennifer Ruggiero, those safeguards are not good. Good enough, and frankly, she opposes this bill. And she is the Secretary of the Secretariat for Family and Pastoral Life in the Diocese of Metuchen, also Director of the Office of Human Life and Dignity. Sean Crowley, Senior Media Relations Director for Compassion and Choices. Let me read a bunch of comments here, and we'll get back to our conversation. A Facebook comment from Jay. He says, since I contracted HIV as a teenager, I've always imagined what my final hours might look like. AIDS was a death sentence back then. Because of that, I've always had a plan for how I will play that final scene, regardless of the government. I live in New Jersey. I may die in New Jersey one day. This law matters. A Facebook comment from Don. No one would do this lightly, and evidently there are plenty of checkpoints. It should be legal. An email from PJ. While I'm generally in favor of this, I'm concerned about the lack of value for the elderly in this country and want to be sure there are safeguards to prevent family from coercing people into this route because they are made to feel inconvenient or a burden. Sean, let me pick up on what PJ just said there. And there are certainly potential anecdotes, and there could be families who wish a family member ill and just don't want to have to deal with them anymore. Does this law provide enough protections?
Well, yes, it does. In fact, Disability Rights Oregon confirmed in a letter in February 2019 that has never to its knowledge received a complaint that a person with disabilities was coerced or being coerced to make use of the act. And in addition, a Journal of Medical Ethics report about the Oregon Death with Dignity Act said rates of assisted dying in Oregon showed no evidence of heightened risk for the elderly woman, the uninsured, people with low educational status, the poor, the physically disabled or chronically ill, minors, people with psychiatric illnesses, including depression or racial or ethnic minorities compared with background populations. And I would like to address one other thing that Jennifer brought up.
Sure.
The idea that people who utilize medical aid in dying don't have family support is really quite insulting. There was actually a study done, interviews with people who utilize the law, and they interviewed family members. And the family members understood that only the dying patient can determine if they're suffering. And they certainly said that they actually got some closure when the person they loved no longer had to suffer needlessly and could die peacefully in their sleep.
Do you want to respond to that, Jennifer?
Well, I want to get back to the point that you raised before. Basically, there's no requirement for a witness to be present during the time of ingestion of the medication. There's no requirement for a family member to even be notified. There's no requirement for a healthcare professional to be present during the ingestion of the medication. So I don't know how we can be so sure that a person is not being coerced to take the medication or even self-ingesting it when there's no requirement for a witness to be present. So that's a big fear we have, that, you know, all of these things, a person could actually go in distress. We've had anecdotal cases, again, where people have taken the medication and 65 hours later woken up not dead. Someone could vomit from the medication, not take it properly. So there's all kinds of things. And the fact that the family does not have to be notified, that's a very scary thing. I mean, I journeyed with my mom for 4 years going through cancer treatments. And if I went down one day and found her dead, that would really rip our family apart. So I think that there's a lot of different things that we need to be concerned about. And I'm sorry I didn't mean to be insulting about the family support. But I think in today's society, a lot of times we live in silos. We are all autonomous. We're not as family-oriented as we used to be. And I think we're called to be working more in community to see how we can support each other in these final days and not just give someone a lethal prescription, even if it's a well-thought-out decision. I think we need to look for life-affirming ways to handle the final days of someone's life and not just handing them a lethal prescription.
Well, you know, Jennifer, I just have to be personal here in that I have been at bedsides of people who have died, I think as probably most of our listeners, and some of them have chosen death for themselves, some of them have not. But it I think we have to be very careful to think that just because someone chooses death, that somehow they're not supported by their family or that they're not choosing this freely with an open and clear mind and they want this for themselves.
Right. But we all already have the opportunity to reject or decline any kind of treatment. We already have the ability to have advanced directives for health care should we not be able to make our own decisions. We can appoint a health care proxy. I don't think that it's proper that we give people lethal prescriptions. I think nature takes its course. We make people as comfortable as we can with palliative care. But to take someone's life, to end someone's life deliberately, is philosophically opposed to what the doctors are do no harm, are called to do. And I think we have to be very careful that if we start this, and apparently we're going to be starting it in New Jersey, that there's no reversing it. People can make decisions that are final. And sometimes it's just a matter of being depressed, where sometimes it's people feeling like they have a duty to die as opposed to having the right to live.
Sean, you want to respond to that? Then I'll get a different Sean from New Jersey to join us.
The idea that all these family members are scheming to kill someone who's already dying is kind of absurd on its face.
No, and I didn't say that. I said there's anecdotal.
You just spoke, Jennifer, at length, so let me finish, please.
Go ahead, Sean.
So my point is, when my father was dying, when he had these horrible seizures, he said, I don't want to do this anymore. Nobody is coercing him. And fortunately, he went into a coma and died. But not everybody has that experience. Some people have what's called breakthrough pain. The reasons people cite an organ, there are multiple reasons. And if you add them up, it's actually nearly 400%. There's multiple reasons, including pain. And the idea that doctors are opposed to this is also wrong. There have been numerous national studies showing that physicians at large support this option, especially, by the way, in states where they don't have it, where they wish they had the option. And the New Jersey Medical Society never surveyed its members. They just made a decision from senior management.
Well, Sean, let me just jump in. One last point.
This is very important about the witness issue. So why would you want to have someone, quote, witness somebody's death? That means if they show up, then the person is going to feel coerced to go through with taking the medication. As Jennifer mentioned, some people don't take the medication. And two doctors have already said the person has made this decision without coercion. Two witnesses have said that, including one who's not a family member, but one who can be a family member. So you have a great balance there. And that's important. I get it. But to say that the government or somebody has to be there to witness the person take the medication is coercive in nature and certainly not a good idea. And one last point.
Very quickly.
There's something called palliative or terminal sedation, which is totally unregulated, where if somebody has breakthrough pain, the doctor medicates them into a coma. They withhold nutrition and fluids until they die of either the underlying condition or dehydration. So the idea that this – the most overregulated in a lot of ways – end-of-life care option is somehow derelict is just absurd on its face.
Let me get Sean, a different Sean from New Jersey, to join our conversation. Sean, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. My concern was over the debate that was conducted in the Senate. The two senators who spoke in favor of this bill were acting like there was no such thing as advanced medical directives. They were talking about the specter of being unwillingly hooked up to a respiration machine or a heart-lung machine or whatever. It's my understanding, unless things have changed, if I say I don't want a life-prolonging treatment, I can deny that and require my doctor to keep me comfortable. In fact, if I'm not comfortable, that would be grounds for medical malpractice.
Well, Sean, let me toss that first to Jennifer Ruggiero just to get her response, and then from Sean Crowley.
Well, absolutely. There's something called Advanced Directive for Healthcare, and we always recommend that someone that fills one of those out gets a healthcare proxy that they discuss their end-of-life wishes with and that understands them, and so that if they need to be relayed to the doctor or the physician, that they can do it for the patient. That's something we highly recommend people do, because you never know what's going to happen tomorrow. You could get hit by a bus and be in a bad state. But under this law, you can be competent and make this decision, and that's a little bit different. Our position is you can already decline or reject any kind of treatment, whether it be chemo treatment or whatever. You already have the right to do that. This law is really just giving immunity to the physician so that they don't get charged with prescribing lethal drugs.
Let me comment from Robert. He says, I'm a doctor. The idea of this bill is absurd. Doctors take an oath to protect the life of a patient from birth to death. We cannot abandon this oath. Sean, let me go back to you. And you mentioned the Medical Society of New Jersey. They did say it was fundamentally incompatible with physicians' role as healer. The American Medical Association, the American College of Physicians, they do oppose this kind of legislation.
Yeah, but they're not listening to their members. Every state that's done a medical survey of their members shows the majority favors it, whether it's state or national. That's the problem. You've got entrenched leadership that doesn't want to change their ways, that doesn't acknowledge that modern medicine has its limits. And by the way, we support advanced directives too. And guess what? There's immunity for doctors for advanced directives. The problem with the advanced directives,
by
the way,
that's not the intentional killing. That's not intentional killing of someone.
Well, go ahead, Sean.
Well, I'm sorry, but I'm not going to sit here and listen to her talk about killing. The doctors don't kill anybody. The patient gets medication they decide to take. And, you know, that's the problem with our opponents is they want to criminalize and stigmatize people who use this option. And it's frankly shameful. Polling shows that people of all faiths support this option, including Catholics. And, let's not forget Catholics disagree with the church on birth control and a host of other issues. So, to use this negative terminology and make it out like people are committing some kind of crime is just heinous.
Let me read some more comments. Hold on. Let me just read some more comments here. A Facebook comment from Don. No one would do this lightly, and evidently there would be plenty of checkpoints. It should be legal. And also from Whitney says, my brother was diagnosed with a debilitating brain tumor that left him severely disabled. He attempted suicide. And if I could have taken away that pain from him in a dignified way, I would have. Jennifer, what's your response to Whitney?
Well, I'd like to go back to the whole idea of the polls. I think that many people that are polled don't understand what this bill what this bill does. I think a lot of people think that you're given an injection and you are surrounded by family members and you slip off into a coma and you have a peaceful death. That's not what this bill does. You go to the doctor, you go several times, you do it in writing, but you go home with a lethal prescription. No witness, no family member has to be present. No doctor has. It could be very ugly, and you don't have to be surrounded by people, and there's no witness. And also, the death certificate, it writes that the underlying condition, whether it be cancer, whatever, is the cause of death, when in fact, it's the lethal prescription that causes the death. And that's what I was saying about killing. When you have an advance directive, you can't check off a box saying, I want to intentionally kill myself. You can check off boxes that say, I don't want to be put on I don't want to have life support, I don't want to have this or that, or feeding, whatever. But you can't say, check off a box and say, I would like to take a lethal prescription. And that's intentionally ending your life.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Sean, do you have a quick response to that? And then we'll get Deb from Hunterdon County to join us.
Yes. The purpose of death certificates is to track diseases, to make sure that we spend the money on research for the diseases that are killing people. And, you know, when you die on the operating table, they don't say you died on the operating table. They say you died of the underlying condition. When you die of palliative sedation, they also say that you died of your underlying. When you stop voluntarily eating and drinking, they say that's what you died of the underlying condition. The important thing is also for insurance purposes, people should not, their family should not be able to lose their heir, their right to insurance, so life insurance. So the point is, it's not a lie. It's what we need to research and cure diseases. That's the point of the death certificate.
Let me get Hold on one second. I'm sorry. I keep doing this to you, Jennifer, and I apologize. Let me get Deb from Hunterdon County to join us. Deb, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. We're almost out of time, but I want to get your comment on the air.
Yeah, it can be quick. What I know is that these people are going to die. People who are using this option, they're going to die. They want to live. This bill makes it possible for the people in the final days of their lives to choose how much suffering they can bear. Palliative care can't control all the pain. This makes it possible for people to choose how much suffering they can bear.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And in many ways, Jennifer and Sean, that's what we're talking about, suffering. Jennifer, quickly.
Yeah, I mean, we all suffer. There's suffering in everyone's life. I mean, there's suffering and there's happy days. I mean, tell me someone in the world that hasn't suffered. Tell me that someone that's deeply depressed and just lost their job or lost a child isn't suffering so deeply. How do we measure one person suffering against another? If one person is suffering because they're fearing the end of their life and the pain and the lack of being able to do it, I totally understand that. That's completely difficult. I've gone through it with my mother and my father, but someone could have an equal amount of suffering in the middle of their lives or the beginning of their lives. And to allow this one segment of the population to have it okay for them to intentionally kill themselves or end their lives, however you want to call it, is setting off a mixed message to the rest of the population.
Sean,
we all suffer.
Sean, I'm giving you the last word. Go ahead.
All right. So end-of-life suffering is completely different from other kinds of suffering that Jennifer's referencing. And again, only the person who's suffering can make that determination. The people who get this medication literally wait to the bitter end of their suffering before they take it. That's what the statistics show. And so why should someone else, Jennifer or the church or anybody, determine how much suffering somebody else should endure? Only the dying patient should make that decision. And that's what this bill is about.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Sean Crowley, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much, Marty.
And Jennifer Ruggiero, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and we can carry on this conversation. Thanks for joining us.